Okay, good morning, everybody. This is Bio 241. Welcome to class, October 15th. We started the autonomic nervous system, completed the regular nervous system chapter today, and we'll finish up autonomic nervous system, maybe move into special senses. But let's take a look at the schedule real quick before I ask and see if there's any questions of any kind. I can turn these lights off. That's really good. So the schedule we see right here, today's the 15th. And so that little asterisk means that there was a emergency drill this morning, 10:15. There's also going to be one tonight. Do I have it listed tonight as well down here? No, I don't have it. I think it's at 7:15 tonight. I'm not sure. 7 something. Those of you that have lab, the later lab, might be influenced by that. I'm not sure. I don't know if they make you go outside, go to Starbucks or whatever, but just follow the instructions of your instructor. So next time is the second lecture exam, and it's going to cover chapters 4, 5, 7, and 9, and we're going to get done with 9 today, just in time. And so for that exam, you'll need a pencil, super eraser. Make sure your eraser works. Make a mark on a clean piece of paper. Make sure it disappears completely, doesn't smudge up. A Scantron, and you got to make sure that Scantron is in good shape, because otherwise I won't be able to grade it. I might have you go buy another one sometime and fill it in again, because if they're all wrinkled up and they'll get stuck in the Scantron grader, and then I won't be able to grade anybody else's test until a service guy comes out and rips the machine. So make sure your Scantron is in good shape, and a picture ID as well. I don't think you need a calculator for this exam. If you do, I'll send you an email, but I don't think you need a calculator for this particular exam. All right, so is there a question about the exam coming up next time? All right, I'll try to get here and kick that other astronomy class out early so that you can get as much time as possible taking the test. So don't be late next time. So that's all I think I will say about that. And then after the test, a week from today, we'll finish up the sensory chapter. Oh, wow, then we just have a short time before the next exam, exam number 3. All right, 10, 11, 12... 13. That's the way it goes. All right. Well, after Tuesday, you're going to be halfway done with the class. I don't know if it feels like you're halfway done or not, but you will be. That seems pretty fast to me. So study hard over the weekend, and congratulations for persevering and getting through the class. All right. Any questions on autonomic nervous system that we have been talking about before? I guess I would like to know what the effector organs are for the autonomic nervous system. What are the effector organs? I heard smooth muscle, I heard cardiac muscle. And glands, that's right. What are the effector organs for the somatic nervous system? Only skeletal muscle, right? So somatic is voluntary, autonomic is automatic. And there are some autonomic fibers that go to some somatic regions on your body. These are regions that are not deep inside body cavities. Like, for instance, your integumentary system has Richter pili muscles. They are under the control of the autonomic nervous system, right? But they're not deep inside a body organ. Nonetheless, we still consider them to be part of the, well, they are controlled by the autonomic nervous system. Visceral has a tendency to confer things that are deep inside body cavities. Somatic are other more superficial parts of your body. That's why we say somatic nervous system doesn't go to body cavities, but to more superficial regions that contain things like muscles, skeletal muscles. So there's a connotation that somatic means voluntary, because that's where we find voluntary muscles. But we can't find autonomic or smooth muscle in superficial regions of the body, so that terminology is not perfect. All right, so autonomic nervous system, the effectors are cardiac muscle, smooth muscle, and glands. And how many divisions can you break the autonomic nervous system down into? There are two, and you got to know their names, parasympathetic and sympathetic. And generally speaking, what's the relationship between those two divisions? Antagonistic to each other. I just did a Google search because I wanted to find out a little bit more about autonomic nervous system. And everything that I found on the internet, like Wikipedia, it said that these divisions are complementary to each other. And I looked at the next website, and it said complementary to each other. And the next one, and the next one, and the next one, and they all said complementary to each other. And I don't know, I'm kind of horrified when I read that. because you should really appreciate they're antagonistic, right? Just like your gas pedal and brake pedal, they work against each other. And as a result of that, that provides precise control and balance. So in a sense, they're complementary, but you know, fundamentally, they work in opposition or antagonistic to each other. Furthermore, we're going to actually look at some divisions of the autonomic nervous system, which are classically defined as complementary. So that's and that's going to be just a little bit different. All right, so the two divisions, sympathetic, parasympathetic, they exit the central nervous system in different ways. And we looked at sympathetic last time. So sympathetic nervous system is what we call thoracolumbar. That means outflow pathways, right, originate from T1 down to, I think, L2. That's the only way sympathetic signals can leave the central nervous system. They don't leave through cranial nerves or thoracic nerves, for instance, or, well, I'm sorry, through sacral nerves or cervical nerves. And this is the typical pattern that we see, and I want to get my cursor back, sorry. Okay. All right, so remember, all motor pathways leave through the ventral root of the spinal cord because ventral root is 100% motor. What about the dorsal root? 100% sensory, right? So motor signals always leave the ventral root. Then it joins together, the dorsal and ventral join together to make a spinal nerve. And then these sympathetic fibers leave the spinal nerve and enter the sympathetic chain ganglia, which you should kind of think of as auxiliary spinal cords just for sympathetic outflow. And they're located on either side of the vertebral column. And here is a ganglion. So sometimes we call these the sympathetic chain ganglia. And if there's a ganglion, what's the definition of a ganglion? I like that. It's a group of nerve cell bodies and dendrites someplace other than the central nervous system, like in the peripheral nervous system, right? And so these are all non-myelinated areas, so they're going to kind of look gray when you take a look at them. On this particular slide, I only see a nerve cell body here, but this is going to be loaded with nerve cell bodies, all right? And so since this is a ganglia, sometimes that motor neuron that leaves, the central nervous system stops right here, synapses on a second neuron, which then re-enters the spinal nerve and joins that spinal nerve to find whatever particular effector organ that it is supposed to innervate. So a typical autonomic outflow pathway requires two neurons back to back. One is called the, what's the first one called? Here's a ganglion, so it's the preganglionic neuron. The nerve cell body is in the spinal cord. And the postganglionic neuron, right, has a nerve cell body in the ganglion itself, the ganglion proper. Okay. So that's what I see right here. But this preganglionic nerve fiber doesn't always have to synapse within that first ganglia that it enters, but it can arise through the sympathetic chain one or two levels, or it can descend one or two levels. Or there are even some preganglionic fibers that actually pass straight through the sympathetic chain and go to a ganglia which is in front of the vertebral column. And these are what we call the preganglionic, prevertebral ganglia. They're also called collateral ganglia. And that is where the postganglionic fiber originates for this particular nerve. And all these nerves that pass straight through the sympathetic chain and go to a prevertebral ganglia, these are all going to be called splanchnic nerves. Right? I don't know if you can remember that from anatomy, but that's some really good basic neuroanatomy that you should be aware of. All right, what else do I want to say about this thing? These figures are almost correct. These definitely are called rami or rami communicantes. And actually, the preganglionic fiber enters the sympathetic chain from the second one and then re-enters from the first one. So this illustration is a little wrong, but it's not really an anatomy book, so we can't be too upset with these guys. Okay, one is white and one is gray. And that's because the preganglionic is, what, myelinated or not myelinated? Anybody remember? Is myelinated, right? And the postganglionic is not myelinated. And that's why these communicantes are designated either white or gray. So the white one is really the second one. The gray one is really the first one, but I think you should at least know that the preganglionic is myelinated and the postganglionic is not myelinated. All right, so what we see right here in the sympathetic nervous system, this is an important physiologic point, is that here is a single sympathetic preganglionic nerve leaving the central nervous system. And when it enters the sympathetic chain, look at the number of bifurcations that it has. Right, it's the same electrical impulses that can arise through the sympathetic chain, descend through the sympathetic chain, or even re-enter the spinal nerve at that same level that it enters. And there's even a fourth possibility, that it can enter a splanchnic nerve and go to a collateral ganglia someplace. And as a matter of fact, if it descends, it can enter another splanchnic nerve to go to a collateral ganglia someplace. So the point here is that the sympathetic nervous system, when it becomes activated, right, we consider it that it activates everything in the sympathetic nervous system. We call that mass activation. So sympathetic signals go everywhere. It is not discrete. Right, so if sympathetic outflow takes place, it pretty much goes everywhere in the body because of all these divergent pathways. Right? And also, these signals do come back together, like we see these two splanchnic nerves rejoin each other. And we call that convergence. In case one of these splanchnic nerves is damaged, these sympathetic signals still get to this collateral ganglia. Right? So that sort of acts like a nerve plexus. So sympathetic division is characterized by mass activation because of divergence and convergence of signals. The parasympathetic nervous system, okay, on the other hand, is very discrete. Okay? So here, and the parasympathetic nervous system has craniosacral outflow. So it's from cranial nerves, 7, 9, and 10. Primarily 10 is the most important because we can see it going to many places in the body, and that's how it got its name. Not 10, but what is the name? The name is the vagus nerve, right? And vagus means vagabond. This nerve wanders around all over the place. So it's a very important parasympathetic neuron. Excuse me a second. All right, so there are still preganglionic and postganglionic fibers for parasympathetic outflow, but there's a little bit of difference. All right, the preganglionic fibers for parasympathetic are long, and the postganglionic fibers are very short or even microscopic. So the ganglia for parasympathetic outflow are located on the surface or even inside the target organ. So those nerve fibers don't have to go very far at all to produce their effects, right? So the solid color is always the preganglionic fiber, and you can see that they are long. Contrasting with the sympathetic nervous system, the preganglionic fiber is short and the postganglionic fiber is long. So that's a little bit of a difference. Another difference is we said that the sympathetic is characterized by mass activation, but the parasympathetic, right, can have discrete effects in the body because there isn't as much divergence and convergence of nerve fibers. So that's an important consideration or distinction. All right. So following along that same kind of thought, if something enters the blood through a capillary, where does it go in your body? It goes everywhere, right? So that's, in a sense, kind of confirms this thought of mass activation. And there are neurohormones that are secreted by the adrenal medulla, right, that enter the blood and carry an autonomic signal through everywhere in the body, right? So if it's an autonomic signal that goes everywhere in the body, which of the autonomic nervous system parts you think is it stimulating, right? Is it sympathetic or parasympathetic? Right, the adrenal medulla is sympathetic, right, because of mass activation. So signals from the adrenal medulla go everywhere and provide that sympathetic stimulation everywhere in the body. The other interesting thing about that adrenal gland is that I don't see a postganglionic fiber. I only see a preganglionic fiber. Right, so here's a preganglionic fiber passing straight through the sympathetic chain, entering a splanchnic nerve, and it even passes through a prevertebral ganglia and goes directly to the adrenal medulla. The chromaffin cells of the adrenal medulla act like the postganglionic fibers. When they sent acetylcholine from the preganglionic fiber. They release epinephrine and norepinephrine, which then are picked up by capillaries delivered everywhere in the body and can then stimulate adrenergic receptors. Right? What kind of receptor can sense acetylcholine? That's a cholinergic receptor, right? And the receptors that can sense epinephrine and norepinephrine are called adrenergic receptors. I'm not sure I mentioned that, but you should be aware of that. All right, so norepinephrine and epinephrine from the adrenal medulla also enhance mass activation of the sympathetic nervous system. There's no counterpart to that in the parasympathetic nervous system. All right, so here is something interesting. So usually we think of norepinephrine as a neurotransmitter because it's released by a neuron, right? And it transmits a signal to a neighboring neuron. And in this particular case from the adrenal medulla, it is releasing norepinephrine, but it enters the blood and it is acting more like a hormone. So in that particular case, how would you like to consider norepinephrine? Is it a neurotransmitter or is it a hormone? Yeah, it's a combination of both, right? So it is really a neurohormone, and the adrenal medulla is the first example that we have looked at where there is that nice, obvious interface between the nervous system and endocrine system. And in the back of your mind, you should have a way to think about the nervous system, that contrast that with the endocrine system, and that is the nervous system provides information very rapidly over long distances in the body, but its effects are very short-lived, right? If something can have a very fast onset, then its duration is for a short period of time. The endocrine system, on the other hand, takes longer to travel all over the body and to have its effects felt. So it's still long range, but it's much slower to have an effect all over the body. But as a result of that, it has a much longer lasting effect. Right, so nervous system has a fast onset but doesn't last very long. Endocrine system takes longer to have an effect, but it lasts also for a longer period of time. And so those two systems are complementary to each other. That's okay if you use that thought in comparing endocrine system and nervous system. All right, so all of these connections in these ganglia, whether they're parasympathetic or sympathetic ganglia, these are synapses, right? And they are chemical synapses. And what does a chemical synapse use to convey information from the pre to the postganglionic cell? Yeah, it's a neurotransmitter. And what I'm thinking, it's a chemical, right? So this is a chemical synapse, not an electrical synapse. So we're interested in knowing something about these neurotransmitters. Here is the really easy point. All preganglionic fibers release acetylcholine. All right, every single one. It doesn't matter if it's sympathetic or parasympathetic, release acetylcholine. So all of those are cholinergic neurons, and the receptor type of the postganglionic fiber in all ganglia is a nicotinic type. It's not muscarinic, right? It's nicotinic. So what is the effect of preganglionic stimulation on the postganglionic fiber? By knowing that, you should tell me what it is, and you could tell me 100% of the time what will it be. It will be excitatory, right? Because a nicotinic receptor is always involved with a sodium channel, and it opens up, and we know sodium is high outside the cell, sodium rushes in, causing depolarization, and that's the definition of excitation, because it will bring the membrane potential closer to threshold, or even meet threshold. All right, so that's the easy thing about the synapse between all pre- and postganglionic fibers. That is not the case at the terminus of the postganglionic fiber. Sometimes the postganglionic fiber releases acetylcholine and sometimes norepinephrine. Generally speaking, the parasympathetic nervous system at the postganglionic fiber is acetylcholine. And as a matter of fact, I can't think of one exception to that rule whatsoever. So you could probably just say it's always acetylcholine from the postganglionic fiber. Now, the receptor on the target tissue is not nicotinic. It's a muscarinic type receptor. And so how does signal transduction occur at the plasma membrane of that target tissue or that target organ? It's not just an ion channel that opens. What's the scheme for a muscarinic type receptor? It is a G protein coupled receptor, right? G protein coupled receptor, and you should probably have a picture in your mind of what those things look like. That's a really good exam figure. Maybe even on the first exam, you had to know something about that, just the overall general architecture. All right, so those G proteins are activated on the inside of the cell, and they can bump into various kinds of channels in the cell membrane. They could be a chlorine channel. And if an activated G protein bumps into a chlorine channel, what happens to the state of the membrane potential then? Okay, if it's, what kind of channel did I say? If I said chlorine channel, I hope I said chlorine. I said calcium channel, I wanted to say chlorine. Okay, I'm glad I asked. If it bumps into a chlorine channel, it causes a chlorine channel to open up, what's the effect of membrane potential? It will hyperpolarize or inhibit the cell. If that activated G protein bumps into a sodium channel and it opens up the sodium channel, what's going to be the effect on that cell? It's going to excite. It's going to cause depolarization. That's right. So these muscarinic receptors have a number of different types. We're not going to really learn much about these different types, but some can be excitatory, some can be inhibitory, and that is why one neurotransmitter like acetylcholine can have different kinds of effects in different target tissues, because different target tissues will have different kinds of receptors. Right? There's still a G protein coupled receptor, but they're coupled to different kinds of ion channels. So, for instance, on the digestive tract, parasympathetic nervous system is excitatory, but the parasympathetic nervous system on the heart is inhibitory. And that's because they are using muscarinic type receptors that are using G proteins to open up different kinds of ion channels in the cell membrane. Okay. All right, so the sympathetic nervous system. Postganglionic fiber is going to release norepinephrine. That is usually the case. Over 90% of the time, it's norepinephrine. And it's going to bind to an adrenergic type receptor. And that's a G protein coupled receptor. And those adrenergic receptors can either be excitatory or inhibitory depending upon what ion channels open up, just like the muscarinic kind. And there are a few examples where acetylcholine is used as the postganglionic neurotransmitter for the sympathetic nervous system, but we're not going to pay too much attention to that. Okay, so, and then there's maybe even a couple other kinds of neurotransmitters that are neither adrenergic or cholinergic, and we won't look at those either, but there's a little bit more complexity with the sympathetic nervous system. All right, so let's take a look at some of the effector organs and see what the effect of these different divisions of the autonomic nervous system are. And remember, we always want to think of the parasympathetic as the rest and digest, and the sympathetic as fight and flight, and just think of how should a organ behave when you're in a very stressful circumstance, what would be more beneficial to you, and how can that organ behave when you're not in a stressful situation. All right, so sympathetic is stress, parasympathetic is non-stress, and we see that sympathetic stimulation on the iris causes dilation of the pupil. All right, so there are, well, you know what? I got to draw on the board. We haven't looked at the eye just yet. So here is the iris. There are two kinds of muscle fibers. There are radial fibers. I'm sorry, circular fibers. I don't know, can anybody see that? Okay. There are circular fibers, and then there are radial fibers that move like this. So two different kinds of smooth muscle fibers, and then, of course, what's this right here? That's a foramen that light goes through. That is your pupil, okay? That's your pupil. Light doesn't reflect off of it, so it looks very dark or black. Okay, so we said sympathetic stimulation causes dilation. Okay, so under stressful situations, your iris should dilate to let a lot of light in so that you can perceive what's happening around you. Does that make sense? That you want that signal, you need that stimulus to appreciate what's happening in your environment. So what muscles contract, all right, to cause dilation? And it is these radial fibers right here. So sympathetic will cause these to contract. Parasympathetic, on the other hand, are going to cause these to contract. And when a circular muscle contracts, like your orbicularis oris, go ahead, contract your orbicularis oculi, one of them. What happens to your, okay, you did both right there. Okay, what do? You close your eye, right? So a circular smooth muscle, just like a skeletal smooth muscle, when it contracts, right, it closes that orifice down. Right? So parasympathetic, when you don't need to have a lot of light entering the eye because you're not so concerned about your environment, parasympathetic will affect the circular, will cause constriction. Okay, let's look at, how about heart? All right, so here is heart. I'm going to turn these lights back down. So we'll look at these radial and circular fibers in the iris in the next chapter. Here is the heart. All right, so generally speaking, when you're in a stressful situation, what's going to happen to your heart rate and force of contraction? It goes up, right? Those sympathetic is going to be excitatory. And that's what this table shows right here. Sympathetic effect on the heart is increased, what? Heart rate. That's right. So your heart rate increases. And what would you expect then parasympathetic to do? To decrease heart rate. So that is really nice antagonistic effects. And as a result of that, you have precise control and balance of your heart rate. All right. So here are some antagonistic effects nicely shown. But let's go down to strength, force of contraction. Right. If I don't know if you've ever experienced getting run over by a big truck on the freeway, but maybe you're driving down the freeway and you're between two big trucks and all of a sudden one of them has decided to change lanes right into your lane and you have no place to go and you're going to get squished between two trucks like that. And I see that you've lived through that, but at the time you thought for sure you were going to die. What have you ever noticed about your heart? Not only has the rate sped up, but what else is happening? Has anybody ever experienced something like that? Or something similar, you don't have to be on a freeway, but gone through some kind of experience where it looked really, really bad, like you're going to get killed. What happens to your heart? It speeds up, but the force of contraction also increases, and it feels like your heart is going to jump right outside your chest, right? So not only is it fast, but it contracts with a whole lot more rigor as well. We call that strength or force of contraction. So sympathetic activity increases the force of contraction as well as the heart rate. Now, what about the parasympathetic nervous system for strength, the force of contraction? Can you follow that over? What's the effect of parasympathetic nervous system? It has no effect on the strength of contraction at all. So this is kind of strange, right? So there is not, in this particular case, what we call dual innervation. The heart, in terms of strength of contraction, is just singly innervated by the sympathetic nervous system. So there is some loss of precise control that is a result that takes place. All right, so most organs are dually innervated, but there are some really important examples where there is single innervation, and single innervation is usually done by the sympathetic nervous system, which is excitatory. Okay, when we look at heart rate, I might have to write this on the board. When we talk about heart rate, they're going to be really important sooner or later. All right, heart rate is what we call chronotropy. And when we talk about force of contraction of the heart, we call this inotropy. Because there are two different ways how the heart can behave. It can be just the heart rate, force of contraction can stay the same, or the force of contraction can increase and the rate can stay the same, or they both can increase, or they both can decrease. So in this particular case, okay, as far as chronotropy goes, the parasympathetic and sympathetic nervous system can regulate chronotropy of the heart, but only the sympathetic nervous system by itself can regulate inotropy of the heart. Parasympathetic nervous system cannot regulate inotropy or force of contraction. And If it's excitatory, then we would say it has a positive effect. So if there is a signal that excites or increases the chronotropy, then we say it has a positive chronotropic effect. If it slows the heart rate, we say it has a negative chronotropic effect. If it increases force of contraction, we say it has a positive inotropic effect. If it decreases force of contraction, it has a negative inotropic effect. And you could probably tell me of a neural hormone that has a positive inotropic effect on the heart. Could you tell me, could you give me an example of a neural hormone that has a positive inotropic effect on the heart? Somebody had a pretty good idea, but I didn't hear. Like norepinephrine, fantastic. Where does norepinephrine come from in that particular case? The adrenal medulla, right, gets activated when you're in a very stressful situation. Norepinephrine goes into your blood. There are adrenergic receptors on the heart, and that will increase not only the force of contraction, right, but the rate. So norepinephrine has a positive chronotropic and a positive inotropic effect on the heart. Okay, and that was a neurohormone that we just talked about. Okay. Let's see if there is something else that we want to compare on this slide. Let's look at, how about bronchioles, right? Bronchioles are air passageways in your lungs. They do not contain cartilage, so they don't stay open all the time. They can vasoconstrict or vasodilate depending on the state of smooth muscle. When smooth muscle constricts, that causes constriction. And so far we've looked at sympathetic nervous system having an excitatory role. Let's look and see what happens for sympathetic nervous system on these bronchioles, these tubes, these passageways, air passageways in the lungs. Sympathetic nervous system is inhibitory. It causes dilation of bronchioles. And the parasympathetic nervous system causes excitation of those smooth muscles. It causes constriction, right? So here is kind of the opposite effect that you would normally expect, except that when your sympathetic nervous system is activated under stressful situations, do you think it should be harder or easier to breathe? Easier to breathe, and that's what bronchodilation provides. It's easier to get a lot of air in and out of the lungs when there's bronchodilation, and if there's bronchoconstriction, then it's very difficult to ventilate the lungs. Okay, so again, they're antagonistic, but you can't really tell which one is excitatory or inhibitory unless you think of how the sympathetic and parasympathetic relate to each other. Rest and digest versus fight and flight. Let's look at some blood vessels. Blood vessels. Okay. Sympathetic nervous system on blood vessel, and that probably in this particular class, I want you to think of constriction. Vasoconstriction. Sympathetic nervous system is going to cause vasoconstriction. It's going to be excitatory on smooth muscles smooth muscles around blood vessels. So let's think of a balloon. You have a balloon and you got a bunch of water in that balloon. You grab that water balloon and you start to squeeze down on it. What's happening to pressure of that balloon when you start to squeeze down on it? Is it staying the same or is it going up or going down? It's going up, right? And you squeeze, and all of a sudden you squeeze enough, the pressure has increased so much, what's going to happen to the water balloon? It's just going to pop right in front of your face, right? So whenever you vasoconstrict the blood vessel, the blood pressure is going to, just like that water balloon, it's going to increase. If you vasodilate, if you could ever pull that water balloon apart, right, the pressure would decrease. So the same thing would happen with your blood vessels. Dilation is going to decrease blood pressure. So that is one way blood pressure is regulated in your body via vasoconstriction or vasodilation. Typically, the sympathetic nervous system causes vasoconstriction, and the parasympathetic nervous system does nothing. Most blood vessels are not dually innervated. Most blood vessels only get sympathetic nervous system outflow. So what is the overall effect then of your autonomic nervous system on blood pressure? If directly it can only cause vasoconstriction, what does the autonomic nervous system, what is it really geared to do? To increase blood pressure or decrease blood pressure? Increase blood pressure. what's a very prevalent disease, for sure in the United States, maybe all over the world, having to do with blood pressure? Hypertension. Yeah, what is hypertension? Anybody know what hypertension is? Yes, above normal blood pressure. Blood pressure is too high. And probably one of the reasons why it's very prevalent and it's actually kind of hard to treat in some circumstances is because your autonomic nervous system, right, is the innervation is not dual. It's only singly innervated. Only the sympathetic nervous system goes to blood vessels that causes constriction, which then causes high blood pressure. If there was a corresponding division of the parasympathetic nervous system going to blood vessels to cause vasodilation, then your body would have more precise control and balance of blood pressure, right? But you only have the sympathetic nervous system going to cause high blood pressure, and that's probably one of the reasons why hypertension is so prevalent and a problem in our population. All right, so you can kind of look through this list and see that most organs, right, are dually innervated, but some are not. And I want to actually end this and go to another slide. I don't think I put it in this presentation yet. So I got a couple other slides right here. Okay, autonomic nervous system actions. Okay, dual innervation, right? So we're only going to consider organs that have dual innervation, not in that previous case where a target organ only has either sympathetic but not parasympathetic. All right, but if an organ has dual innervation, by far the most prevalent is antagonistic properties, right? Where, and here's an example, sympathetic nervous system will cause pupil dilation, parasympathetic will cause pupil constriction. Or I suppose you could put the heart here in terms of rate. Sympathetic has a positive chronotropic effect, parasympathetic a negative chronotropic effect. But there are other ways that the autonomic nervous system divisions can interact with each other. Another way is complementary, right? A complementary innervation that both sympathetic and parasympathetic will produce similar effects, right? And in terms of secretion of saliva, sympathetic stimulation causes a secretion of thick, viscous saliva. Parasympathetic nervous system will still stimulate the secretion of saliva, right? But without sympathetic stimulation, it's going to be watery. So both increase the production and secretion of saliva, but just the form is going to change depending on whether the sympathetic nervous system is activated or not. So we call that a complementary effect, right? They're not antagonistic to each other. One doesn't decrease the production or secretion of saliva. They both increase, just different forms. Another way of characterizing autonomic nervous system actions is cooperativity, right? So different effects promote the same function, right? Complementary produce similar effects, but cooperative, different effects, but these different effects work together to promote a certain kind of function, right? And the function we are talking about right here is reproduction, reproductive function, and in the male in particular. So the sympathetic nervous system is responsible, I tell you what, let's start here. Parasympathetic nervous system is responsible for erection, right? And that's just for blood to engorge the penis, right, to have an erection. And then the sympathetic nervous system takes over to complete the sexual act for ejaculation. So these things are not antagonistic to each other, but they are cooperative. Right, ejaculation is vastly different than erection, so we can't say they're complementary, but these both participate in the same function, which is the reproductive function. So these are cooperative. So here are some three really good examples of the differences between antagonism, complementarity, and cooperativity if a target organ is dually innervated. And it has to be dually innervated for these to take place. All right, so I can put this away. Oh, one more slide. Single innervation. We looked at a couple examples already. So if it's singly innervated, there can't be antagonism. There can't be anything complementary or cooperative taking place. The really good example of singly innervated organs would be the adrenal medulla. Sympathetic nervous system goes there, and it is always excitatory, so the adrenal medulla is going to secrete norepinephrine and epinephrine. The ventricular myocardium, right? So do you know the difference between atrium and ventricle? Which is the stronger of the two? Which is the stronger of the two? The atrial chambers or ventricular chambers? Okay. The ventricles are big and thick and strong. The atria, which are superior, are pretty weak, right? So we're talking about the big major pumps in the heart, which are the ventricles, right? And only sympathetic nervous system goes to the ventricles. It's excitatory, and it will have a positive inotropic effect. So if it has a positive inotropic effect, what is the effect of sympathetic stimulation on the ventricles? Will it affect the rate? No, it will affect what? The force of contraction, right? Inotropy is force of contraction. Blood vessels. Most are singly innervated. They're excitatory. That's going to cause vasoconstriction. And what happens to blood pressure as a result? It increases. Arrector pili muscles are singly innervated and excitatory by the sympathetic nervous system. It's going to cause contraction of these arrector pili. And then what's the effect going to be that we can observe? Goosebumps, goose pimples, yeah. Okay, and sweat glands are singly innervated, and the sympathetic nervous system is excitatory on sweat glands as well. All right, so under stressful situations, what can you tell me about arrector pili? They'll contract, you'll have goosebumps. What about sweat glands? They'll be excited, you'll have secretion of sweat through these glands. Blood pressure will increase, force of contraction of the heart will increase. And, of course, mass activation of your whole body because of release of norepinephrine from the adrenal medulla. Okay. So that is the single innervation via the sympathetic nervous system. I don't have any examples of organs that are singly innervated by the parasympathetic nervous system. And I don't know if there are any. Somebody might know. Somebody could do a search and see if that is true. All right. So that has to do with the single or dually innervated and some ways we like to think about the autonomic nervous system. Let me go back to the presentation slide show here. All right, well, I'm doing this. Who's got any questions? Any questions? Yes. Yes, I would be happy to do that. Okay, I am wearing a clock on my arm right here. Some people call it by a really fancy name, especially if you spend more than $50 on it. All right, it's a wristwatch, but some people advertise it and talk about it as a chronograph. Have you ever heard that term chronograph? That term chrono has to do with time, right? So chrono is time, and so anything that adjusts the timing of the heart or the heart rate is what we call chronotropy. Chrono is time. Ino, on the other hand, is force. And so inotropy on the heart is regulating the force of contraction. And that's kind of why I mentioned this. If you ever got into looking to you like it was a life-threatening situation, not only would your heart rate increase, but the force of contraction would increase as well. Right, so you would notice your heart rate is speeding up like crazy, but it would feel like your heart is going to jump outside your chest. So in those particular cases, there would be an increase in heart rate or chronotropy, an increase in chronotropy, but also an increase in force of contraction of the heart, and that would be inotropy. So inotropy is force of contraction. Chronotropy is the rate of contraction. And the parasympathetic nervous system can affect the rate of the heart, but not the force of contraction. Parasympathetic nervous system is a negative chronotropic effect, but it has no effect whatsoever on the inotropy of the heart. Sympathetic stimulation, on the other hand, is both a positive chronotropic and positive inotropic agent on the heart. Yep. Yeah, I don't really use them in any other case. Chronotropy and inotropy. Some people might like to borrow those terms for other things, but I haven't seen it. Okay. Let's look at some neurotransmitters. Here is a really good exam figure. Let me see how many other figures we have to talk about. Not too many. A couple more. Okay. So I see nice central nervous system, and on this particular slide, I can see that parasympathetic in what looks blue to me is what? Craniosacral outflow? Sympathetic nervous system kind of looks red to me is what? Thoracolumbar outflow. So this matches up really nice. And in 99.999% of the time, in order for an autonomic signal to get from the central nervous system to an effector organ, how many neurons does it take? Two, a preganglionic and a postganglionic, and there's an interface, there's a synapse within a ganglia. If it's a parasympathetic nervous system, we call it a terminal ganglion, which is on the surface of the organ or inside the organ that it is innervating. So the preganglionic fiber is long, the postganglionic fiber is short. The neurotransmitter within the ganglion is acetylcholine. And you notice that whether it is parasympathetic or sympathetic, and in every ganglion, the nervous system is going to release, the preganglionic fiber is going to release acetylcholine. Right? So the preganglionic fiber is cholinergic. And the receptor on the postganglionic fiber is always going to be a nicotinic type receptor, so it's always excitatory. Acetylcholine is 100% excitatory on the postganglionic fiber. So you see this, draw this out if that's not making sense, right? So here's cranial parasympathetic, here's sacral parasympathetic, and then here is thoracolumbar sympathetic. Now on the visceral effectors, visceral effectors like skeletal muscle. Is that true? Could it ever be skeletal muscle? If it's a visceral effector? No, it can't be, right? That's only somatic, right? So if it's a visceral effector, what kind of organ is it? There can be three kinds. Cardiac muscle, smooth muscle, glands, but never skeletal muscle. Okay. So what is the neurotransmitter on these visceral effectors? Cardiac muscle, smooth muscle, or glands? For the parasympathetic nervous system, it is acetylcholine, right? And acetylcholine down over here. And the receptors on the target organs are going to be muscarinic in type. They're not nicotinic. And if they're muscarinic, they can either be excitatory or inhibitory, just depending on the organ, right? And for instance, in the digestive tract, those muscarinic receptors are going to be excitatory on the digestive tract because that's a characteristic of the parasympathetic nervous system, right? Rest and digest. But on the heart, they're going to be inhibitory, right? Parasympathetic stimulation on the heart inhibits the heart. It slows the heart rate down. So muscarinic can either be excitatory or inhibitory. For the sympathetic outflow pathway, the neurotransmitter is going to be norepinephrine. And that's true in this particular case, I don't really know what it is, 90% of the time, 95% of the time, but the majority of the time, and for this class, that's really what we're considering, is that it's going to be norepinephrine. And the adrenergic receptors on the target tissue can either be excitatory or inhibitory because those are G protein coupled receptors as well. Okay, so nicotinic at all ganglions, but on the target tissue, they could be muscarinic, right? Or, as a matter of fact, they're all going to be G-protein coupled receptors, whether they're muscarinic or adrenergic receptors. Here is one exception, right? The innervation of the adrenal medulla only has the preganglionic fiber. That's probably why it's in bold a little bit. There is no postganglionic fiber, and that's because the cells of the adrenal medulla are acting like the postganglionic fiber, but they release norepinephrine and epinephrine, right, when they are stimulated by the preganglionic fiber, and that enters the circulation. And this slide is almost complete because I see circulation right here, but if you wanted to label this blood vessel, what would you call this blood vessel? A capillary, right, because that's the only kind of blood vessel that allows for exchange. All right, so that's how these. And if you want to cross off hormones right here, because we know much more about that, these are really what? Neurohormones, right, that go into the circulation and then carry that sympathetic signal everywhere in the body. That's kind of confirming what? Mass activation. All right. Well, at the beginning of this chapter, remember we saw a typical scheme for a somatic motor outflow pathway? Somatic motor means going to skeletal muscle. How many neurons did it take to get from central nervous system to skeletal muscle effector? Just one, right? Okay. And that skeletal muscle only has nicotinic type receptors, so the effect of a nerve impulse from a somatic motor neuron is always going to be what on a skeletal muscle? Excitatory. And when we get to muscle, we'll see that the special junction between them is built in such a way that a skeletal muscle has to contract when a nerve impulse goes down that nerve fiber. Can never make up its mind to do anything else. But here we see some smooth muscle, right? I see something kind of like a stretched out football. I don't see striations. This is muscle. And it is smooth muscle, and it is under involuntary control. You can't cause smooth muscle to contract. Both the sympathetic and parasympathetic nervous system might go to smooth muscle in some parts of your body, and they're going to release different kinds of neurotransmitters. All right, so here we see a sympathetic neuron, and it enters this tissue that has a bunch of smooth muscle, and that nerve impulse doesn't have to reach the axon terminus to release neurotransmitters. There are what we call varicosities all along the axon. And in these varicosities, there are synaptic vesicles containing neurotransmitter. And if a nerve impulse goes past this little varicosity right here, it's going to open up calcium channels. It's going to cause release of that neurotransmitter into the extracellular space. And that neurotransmitter will have an effect on the smooth muscle. Here is a parasympathetic neuron. Right? And as a nerve impulse passes through these varicosities, it's going to release a parasympathetic neurotransmitter, which will bind to muscarinic receptors on this smooth muscle cell. Right? And so let's zoom into this region right here. I tell you what, before we go, when we see varicosities on the axon of a nerve fiber, sometimes we call these synapses en passant, or synapses all over the place. As a nerve impulse passes by, they're going to release neurotransmitter. All right, so here we have a smooth muscle. Unlike a skeletal muscle, it can decide on what to do. Skeletal muscle can never make a decision. It just contracts. So here we have that smooth muscle, and I see some receptors on this top part of the membrane and the bottom part over here. And what can you tell me? What shape does this look like to you of this receptor? It's a G protein coupled receptor, right? Exactly. So these are adrenergic down over here, cholinergic, but in particular, these are going to be muscarinic type G protein coupled receptors. All right, so when acetylcholine is released from the parasympathetic neuron, it's going to bind to the cholinergic receptors. And it will have some kind of effect on the smooth muscle cell. When a nerve impulse comes down the sympathetic neuron, it's going to release norepinephrine, bind to this G protein coupled receptor. It's going to have another effect on this smooth muscle cell, and the effects are going to be antagonistic. All right? And so then this smooth muscle cell looks at the balance of the signals between norepinephrine and acetylcholine, and then what is it going to do? It's going to decide on what it should do. Right, based on that input. Skeletal muscle never has that ability to do that because it only gets, what, excitatory signals from the somatic motor neuron. So smooth muscle changes its properties. It can be adjusted up and down. It just isn't turned on or off. Okay, so autonomic neurons are a little bit different because they have varicosities. All right, let's think about adrenergic stimulation from norepinephrine in particular on various kinds of target tissues, and we're going to compare cardiac muscle and smooth muscle. We're not even going to think about glands, but we're just going to think about different kinds of muscle. So adrenergic stimulation from what kind of neurotransmitter? Norepinephrine, yeah. Causes both excitation and inhibition depending on the tissue. So what do these different tissues have to have? Same neurotransmitter, but different receptors. So this is hugely important in terms of clinical practice. So we got to know something about these different kinds of adrenergic receptors. So we're going to pay really close attention to adrenergic receptors, but not so much muscarinic or for acetylcholine. There are two major subtypes of adrenergic receptors that bind norepinephrine and then change the physiology inside of a cell. They're called alpha and beta, adrenergic receptors. Some tissues have one, right? Some might have the other. There are a couple that might have both. And each, the alpha and the beta, even have some subtypes. And I want you to become familiar with at least three of these. Right? So there's alpha 1 and alpha 2. There's beta 1 and beta 2 type receptors. They're going to have different effects on organs depending on where in their body, but there are some things that are common. All of these, alpha 1, alpha 2, beta 1, beta 2, are all G protein coupled receptors. And G protein coupled receptors work through a second messenger system. All right, so what's the first messenger for alpha 1 receptor? Okay, it's the ligand. I agree. I like it. And it's always outside the cell. What is that ligand that's going to bind to that G protein coupled receptor if we're talking about adrenergic stimulation? It's going to be, I heard it, it's norepinephrine, right? So the first messenger is norepinephrine. Or it could be epinephrine if it's coming from the adrenal gland. Okay, so the first messenger is always going to be norepinephrine for these adrenergic receptors. That's why we call them adrenergic. That's basically the definition. All right, but the second messenger changes depending on the subtype. Beta receptors use cyclic AMP as a second messenger. And where do you always find this cyclic AMP that builds up as a result of norepinephrine binding to the receptor? Inside the cell, right? Second messenger is always inside the cell. So if it's a beta adrenergic receptor, cyclic AMP increases inside the cell. If it's an alpha adrenergic receptor, what builds up inside the cell is calcium. Calcium is the second messenger. And that calcium usually comes from outside the cell because that's where calcium is normally at a high concentration. There might be a few places where calcium is high inside the cell, but it's inside a special organelle that keeps it from floating around the cytosol. Does anybody know an organelle that can be high in calcium? It's a reservoir for calcium ions. Okay, and we haven't really looked at it. I mentioned it when we talked about cells, and that is smooth endoplasmic reticulum has high calcium or can have high calcium concentration. When it's excited, it releases that calcium to the cytosol, and then it becomes a second messenger. All right, so let's take a look at some of these things. Let's look at an alpha 1, right? So alpha 1 works through calcium as a second messenger, and in the eye, it causes contraction of the radial fibers of the iris, right? And that dilates the pupils, right? Because that's sympathetic stimulation, pupil dilation is what we would expect. So alpha 1 receptor right here, are you going to say it is excitatory or inhibitory? Alpha 1, causing constriction. Excitatory or inhibitory? Causing constriction, that's excitatory, right? If it causes constriction, excitatory. If it causes dilation, it is inhibitory. It's just going to work that way. So in this particular case, we see alpha 1 as excitatory because it causes constriction. Let's look at another alpha 1. Alpha 1 in skin and visceral vessels. It causes constriction, right? So due to smooth muscle contraction. So alpha 1 in this particular case is what? Excitatory or inhibitory? Excitatory. What was alpha 1 in the first case? Excitatory. That's really nice. Let's go down here to stomach and intestine. Alpha 1, contraction of sphincters. It stimulates the contraction of sphincters, which slows the processing of material through our digestive tract. In a sense, it slows down the digestive processes, right? But if it causes constriction, is this alpha 1 receptor in the stomach and intestine excitatory or inhibitory? If it causes constriction, it is excitatory. So what was the overall theme for these alpha 1s? Excitatory, right? Alpha 1s are excitatory. They increase calcium concentrations inside the cell. So that's a really good take-home message. Alpha 1s are excitatory. The alpha 2, I don't think I have it on this list. If I do, I don't want to talk about it because they're pretty complicated. We don't find them necessarily in target organs, we find them in the central nervous system, and they have a whole bunch of different range of effects. Maybe I'll talk about alpha 2 when we get into the cardiovascular system, but not here. So guess what? You don't have to know anything about alpha 2 for the test that's coming up. But maybe you should know that there is such a thing as alpha 2, because here's an alpha 1. All right. But alpha 1, what should you know? Alpha 1 is excitatory, causes constriction of smooth muscle. Well, what's left? Beta receptors. And these are adrenergic receptors, right? So they respond to norepinephrine. All right, let's look at beta 1. Beta 1 we find in the heart, increases heart rate and also contraction strength. So it has what? A positive chronotropic effect and positive inotropic effect. And we call it, and that's a beta 1 receptor. That leaves only beta 2. All right, so where do we find beta 2? Let's look at bronchioles. All right, beta 2 cause dilation. So a beta 2 receptor, when it's stimulated by norepinephrine, is what? Excitatory or inhibitory on smooth muscles of bronchioles? Inhibitory, right? All right, and that makes perfect sense, right? Because sympathetic is fight or flight. When you're in a stressful situation, you would want bronchodilation so that you have an easier time ventilating, right, your lungs, moving air in and out. All right, so how are you going to, and also it should increase heart rate, beta 1. All right, so how is it really easy for me to remember beta 1 versus beta 2? And that's because beta 1 goes to the heart, beta 2 goes to the lungs. How many hearts do you have?
One.
How many lungs do you have? Two. I see a nice parity there. There's no significance to it other than it's really easy to remember where beta 2 receptors are because you have a right and left lung. Beta 1 receptors because you only have one heart. Okay? You just have to remember, for sympathetic stimulation, it makes perfect sense to have sympathetic stimulation increase, right, or excite the heart, but inhibit the smooth muscles of the lungs to increase ventilation, to make it easier to breathe. All right, so that's all I want you to know about alpha 1, beta 1, and beta 2. Alpha 1 excitatory on smooth muscle all over the place. Beta 1 excitatory on the heart. Beta 2 inhibitory on bronchioles of the lungs. So if somebody is experiencing bronchospasm, okay, what would be maybe a good pharmaceutical agent to have this person breathe in? Okay, what we call a beta 2 agonist, like a norepinephrine type compound. Okay, and that's exactly what's used, okay, to reduce that bronchospasm. All right, but unfortunately, it will also stimulate beta 1 receptors if a person absorbs enough of it when they inhale that drug. And what's the effect then when somebody's taking a bronchodilator? That's an adrenergic agent. What's the effect going to be on the heart? It's going to dilate bronchioles, make it easier to breathe. Well, what is the effect on the heart? Increased force of contraction and rate of contraction as well. Okay, but pharmaceutical companies are looking all the time to find very specific agonists for particularly beta 1 receptors that don't affect beta 2, or things that affect beta 2 but not beta 1. But it's difficult to do that. And the same thing for alpha 1 and alpha 2. But they're getting better and better at that all the time. I think this is the last slide, almost the last slide, not quite the last slide. Okay. What time do we go to? 12:45? More than enough time. Okay. Here we see something that's almost like this slide right here, just in a little bit different form, because we're going to talk about some specific organs in particular. This is also nice. I was going to say it has a somatic outflow pathway, but it doesn't. You could draw one in. Right? How do I know that this is autonomic outflow pathways? Yeah, I see two neurons back to back, right? And if it was a somatic motor, draw a somatic motor neuron here, right? And it's just going to be one, and it's going to go all the way to what effector organ? Skeletal muscle. What's the neurotransmitter going to be? Acetylcholine. What's going to be the receptor on skeletal muscle? And nicotinic cholinergic receptor. Nice. Okay. So let's look at and compare parasympathetic outflow with sympathetic outflow, in particular to some organs. All right. So parasympathetic outflow is always a pre- and post-ganglionic fiber. And The neurotransmitter within the ganglion is always going to be acetylcholine. And as a matter of fact, if we're going to compare every ganglion, what are we going to find? What is this neurotransmitter way over here? Acetylcholine. What is this one over here? Acetylcholine. What's this one over here? Acetylcholine. And the receptors in each of these dendrites are going to be nicotinic, right? So the preganglionic fibers are always excited by the preganglionic fibers. Okay? It's always excitatory. The postganglionic fibers are always excited by the preganglionic fibers because it's always acetylcholine that's used, and there's only nicotinic receptors in these dendrites of the postganglionic fibers. Okay, but now here things change. Let's just look at parasympathetic. So here is the postganglionic fiber, nerve impulse goes down to the axon terminus, and the neurotransmitter for the parasympathetic postganglionic fiber is acetylcholine, right? So that's a cholinergic fiber, but in this particular case, it's not going to stimulate a nicotinic receptor, it's going to stimulate a muscarinic receptor. And what can you tell me about muscarinic receptors? They can be inhibitory or excitatory, depending on how that G protein is coupled to an ion channel, what kind of ion channel it's coupled to. If it's a sodium channel, it is excitatory. If it's a potassium channel, it is inhibitory. If it's a chlorine channel, it is inhibitory. And you should probably have a little bit of a sense of why that is now in the class, I think, maybe. Okay, if not, you got to see me during office hours. All right, so there can be a range of effects because of that muscarinic type receptor. And in particular, what? Inhibitory on the heart, excitatory on the digestive system, as particular examples. All right, let's look at sympathetic division. And as a matter of fact, we're going to break this down into the three receptor types that we talked about, alpha-1, beta-1, beta-2, and where we find those receptors. All right, so the preganglionic fiber releases acetylcholine, stimulates nicotinic receptors on the postganglionic fiber. The nerve impulse goes down to the axon terminus, causes release of norepinephrine, which will bind to adrenergic receptors. And in this particular tissue, right, like for instance blood vessels, alpha-1 receptors are going to cause vasoconstriction, right, and of these blood vessels. Increased blood pressure, for instance, would be one effect of that, because alpha-1s are always excitatory. The second pathway over here, right? This is going to go to the heart. What kind of receptor does the heart have? Beta-1, because you have one heart, right? And what do you know about beta-1 receptors? Don't forget, this is sympathetic. This should match up really nice. Fight or flight is positive chronotropic effect, positive inotropic effect, going to be excitatory. Right, so stimulation of beta-1 adrenergic receptors in the heart increase heart rate and contractility, right? Positive inotropic and chronotropic effects. Now, what about lung? How many lungs do you have? You got two, right? So nerve impulse comes down the preganglionic fiber, releases acetylcholine, stimulates nicotinic receptors on the postganglionic dendrites. Another nerve impulse goes down to the axon terminus of the postganglionic fiber that releases norepinephrine, and in the lung, that norepinephrine is going to bind to a beta-2 adrenergic receptor, causing inhibition, which will then cause dilation of bronchioles so that it's easier to ventilate, right? And that's really a nice fight-or-flight kind of response. All right, so hopefully you've maybe looked at this diagram already. This could be on the test, and look at the study guide to know which ones I blotted out that you should be able to reproduce, right? Or maybe even on a blank piece of paper, just draw this whole thing out once or twice to have a pretty good idea. And if you can, guess what? You're going to be familiar with muscarinic receptors, alpha-1, beta-1, beta-2, and if you understand that and can talk about it, which you probably can, if you can draw this out, you'll freak people out because that's really important information. Right, and it just doesn't seem that there are a lot of people that are really familiar with those kinds of receptors, but they're just critically important to know about. All right, in terms of cholinergic stimulation, right, where do we have acetylcholine released? All neuromuscular junctions, right, on skeletal muscle. All preganglionics, right, all preganglionic autonomic fibers release acetylcholine, and parasympathetic postganglionic fibers, right? Release, all right. Cholinergic receptors have two subtypes, nicotinic and muscarinic, right? And remember, nicotinic are always excitatory because the receptor is part of a sodium channel that opens up. Some are muscarinic, and they can have various effects. And let's take a look, and I think, oh, that's almost the last slide. Can have different effects. So here we have a nicotinic receptor, right? Nice plasma membrane or some kind of membrane, phospholipid bilayer. If this protein binds to acetylcholines, it's going to change conformation of the sodium channel, right? That's the binding of acetylcholine is pretty small. It's a small perturbation on this molecule, but this small change causes a drastic function. That's like your little fingertip poking your friend, right? It's going to cause a major change. Sodium rushes in the cell. You know that to be depolarization or excitation, right? All autonomic ganglia, all neuromuscular junctions, a lot of pathways in the central nervous system. All autonomic ganglia, neuromuscular junctions, and what? All postganglionic parasympathetic fibers as well use acetylcholine. But not this kind of receptor, right? So I do like this list because we're talking about nicotinic type receptors. Postganglionic fibers don't ever stimulate a nicotinic receptor. Postganglionic autonomic nervous system stimulate muscarinic receptors, which are over here. And they act through G-protein coupled receptors. And depending on how these G-proteins interact with various kinds of channels, like here's a potassium channel, if it opens up, that causes hyperpolarization, which is what? Inhibition. That produces inhibition. That's going to hyperpolarize the membrane. Okay? If it is a potassium channel that's normally open and it closes, right, then this positive charge is going to remain inside the cell. That's going to cause depolarization. So if it's a potassium channel that closes, that's excitatory. If it's a potassium channel that opens, that is inhibitory. Opening and closing, opposite effects. Or if that G protein bumps into a sodium or calcium channel that opens it up, that's going to cause excitation because that's depolarization as well. I don't think this is an exam figure. Is it an exam figure? I don't think so, but I think it should be pretty easy to appreciate, right? Nicotinic over here, muscarinic always working through G protein coupled receptors. And if it's a muscarinic, it can be inhibitory or excitatory depending on what kind of channel is opened or closed in the cell membrane. Okay. And then that is it for autonomic nervous system. Unfortunately, we don't have another class meeting before the test, so if you want to ask me a question in person regarding autonomic nervous system, this is probably your last chance because I don't have any office hours on Friday. So if you have any questions, now is a really good time. Yes. Yes, question. Question, question, question. Yes. Good, I'm glad we have some questions. Neuromuscular junction, yes. Okay. Yeah, I can draw. Let me make sure I have a good marker that works well. This is actually pretty fun. I think I only have this one right here. So we're going to look at this first because we're familiar with this. All right, so I drew two neurons right here. So we're not talking about neuromuscular junction just yet, right? And so what are these things called? Dendrites here is, cell body here is, axon, right? All right, so we know that the dendrites, cell body, are the receiving end of the neuron. The axon is the sending end because dendrites and cell body have what kind of channels? Ligand-gated channels. All right, and so ligand-gated channels can produce what? Yeah. All right, so graded potentials. And you should know something about graded potentials. They die away over time. But there's some good things about them, namely they can summate, right? So that's a good thing. All right, so we got graded potentials over here. Can there ever be an action potential on a dendrite or cell body? No, because why? There are no voltage-gated channels. Where do we first find voltage-gated channels? The axon hillock, because all these graded potentials are going to get funneled into the axon hillock. All right, so now we have voltage-gated channels here. I'll just abbreviate that. Voltage-gated channels, and then that action potential is going to be, how much different is it going to be over here compared to over here? Exactly the same, right? And that's going to release neurotransmitter, and so will that stimulate an action potential here? Well, so here's another neuron, and I see what, a dendrite. Will that neurotransmitter cause an action potential on this dendrite? What kind of channels are over here on this dendrite? More ligand-gated. And what does a ligand-gated channel produce? A graded potential. All right, so can there be an action potential here? No, there can't, because there's no voltage-gated channels. But if these graded potentials flow over here to the axon hillock, if it reaches threshold, then you can have an action potential because of what? Voltage-gated channels. Okay. So that's how a neuron pretty much works, right? That graded potential has to be at threshold by the time it reaches the axon hillock before an action potential starts. Okay. So we're going to contrast this with the neuromuscular junction. So I'm going to erase this. And now I'm going to zoom in to, what do we call this junction here? A synapse. What kind of synapse is that? What moves across the synapse? That information moves across the synapse is what? An electrical signal or chemical signal? Yeah, so that's a chemical synapse, right? The neuromuscular junction is a chemical synapse as well. Okay, so here is axon coming down, and the axon terminus on a, so this is what, a somatic motor neuron, right? Somatic motor neuron, just one going from CNS to this effector organ over here. Okay, here is the terminal button. Here is the terminal button on a neuron to dendrite. So here, I'm going to just draw a dendrite right here. Right, so here's a cell body. And then here is the terminal button on the chemical synapse between the presynaptic and the postsynaptic neuron. Which one looks bigger? Does this one look bigger or this one look bigger? This is what? The neuromuscular junction. Can you see that this axon terminus is a lot bigger compared to this one over here? And then here is the muscle cell, right? So here's the muscle cell. Of course, we know that it's striated, right? All right, and so at the neuromuscular junction, what neurotransmitter is going to be released? Acetylcholine, okay? And there are going to be ligand. There are going to be receptors here for acetylcholine. Okay, and do you know the type of the receptor it's going to be here? It's always going to, it's nicotinic. Always excitatory, right? So I'm going to put some. And these are just ion channels. They're not G protein coupled receptors. So there are. I'll draw it over here. Bless you. Ligand-gated channels of what? The nicotinic type? Which means what? They're always excitatory. Always depolarization. Because that's just what these nicotinic channels are. Okay. If this was a neuron, would we see voltage-gated channels here in the in this synapse? I erased it, unfortunately. Where do you first see voltage-gated channels in a neuron? On a dendrite? No. It'd have to go all the way to the axon hillock. Now, this is why muscles are a lot different and why they always obey the somatic motor neuron. Because not only does the neuromuscular junction have ligand-gated channels, it also has, in the neuromuscular junction, or just right outside, a voltage-gated channel. And a voltage-gated channel right here. A VGC. So as soon as acetylcholine binds to this ligand-gated channel, what happens to this voltage-gated channel that's right next to it? Yeah, it gets stimulated, and what does it produce? It produces an action potential, right? So in the neuromuscular junction, action potentials take place, are initiated right here in the neuromuscular junction, and then what does an action potential do? What does an action potential do? It flows over the whole membrane of the muscle cell. Because there are voltage-gated channels everywhere on the membrane of a skeletal muscle cell. Okay. And so anytime a nerve impulse comes down, there's so much acetylcholine released binding to these ligand-gated channels, that threshold is always reached, so these voltage-gated channels are always triggered to open, and that always causes an action potential. Right, so the summation doesn't play a role. These graded potentials don't have to travel any place. So that's why this skeletal muscle cell, whenever there's a nerve impulse here, the only choice this skeletal muscle cell has is to contract. Because these voltage-gated channels are right within the neuromuscular junction. This neuromuscular junction is huge. There's just so much acetylcholine released that the graded potential produced is always at threshold. And an action potential is always produced. And so a skeletal muscle, if it's healthy, can never say, no, I'm busy doing something else, can never make another decision. That's kind of a sloppy diagram, but it kind of conveys what I was thinking. You kind of see what I was saying? Okay. Okay. All right, sign-in sheet is going around. Don't forget, picture ID next time. Eraser, pencil. If you still have any questions, that was a really good question, please come on up to class, front of the class right now. Okay, that's fine. Another question, that's good. Oh, okay. So we have for sympathetic outflow. We have prevertebral and paravertebral. Para means on either side, pre means in front. If it's a prevertebral, there's like one. If it's paravertebral, there are two. And you have two sympathetic chain ganglia. So paravertebral is the same thing as sympathetic chain ganglia.
But I think there's two sympathetic
ganglia? Yeah, there's one on the right, one on the left, on either side. That's what the para stands for. The pre, they're just like a network of one. But they're not linked together like the... Yeah, like the paravertebral. Yeah.
So parasympathetic and sympathetic can both be excitatory or inhibitory, just depends.
Yeah.
Okay.
Because they work through G-protein coupled receptors.
Okay, because we talked a lot about the beta ones as to why they do different things depending on what they're doing.
Oh.
About the parasympathetic, how it determines what it does, if it's excitatory.
Beta 1 and beta 2. Not just, beta 1 is always excitatory.
Okay.
Beta 2 is inhibitory.
But versus?
Muscarinic can be, yeah, we didn't talk a lot about muscarinic because there's a bunch of different kinds of subclasses of muscarinics.
Okay, but it's, alright, so we don't have to know that.
Yeah, maybe in another class.
Alright, that's what I'm wondering. Do I know, like, this was because of all these beta receptors,
yeah.
So we didn't talk about other one, why it did.
This chapter does talk about other classes of muscarinic receptors, but unless it's a question at the end of the chapter that I ask in the study guide or an online question, you're not responsible to know anything about subclasses of muscarinic type receptors.
Okay, so just know that it's a collagenic synapse.
Yeah.
And it could do both.
Yeah, it can both, depending on the tissue. Okay. But nicotinic is always excitatory.
All right, so what's the difference between collagenic and muscarinic?
So there are two kinds of cholinergic receptors, nicotinic and muscarinic.
Okay.
And if it's nicotinic, that's always excitatory. If it's muscarinic, it can be excitatory or inhibitory, depending on what ion channel opens up.
Got it. So muscarinic.
Yeah, so what cholinergic means is that it relies on acetylcholine.
Okay.
And acetylcholine could be nicotinic or muscarinic.
Okay.
Wow, that's really wordy. I know.
I got it.
Okay. See you. Okay. Hi.
It's not on the blackboard.
Ooh, you know what? I have it in exam number 3.
It's still on the exam too.
Yeah, it sure is. I should probably send an email out to everybody.
Okay. Sorry, I was confused.
Yeah. Okay, good. I'm glad you asked. Tell me your name. I don't know your name.
Angeline.
Angeline, nice to meet you. Okay. Hi.
I think I'll make you have office hours after.
If we want to meet a little bit, we can.
Are you? 15 minutes.
Yeah.
I see you on Tuesday.
Yeah, I know. I had to do some other work.
Okay.
Yeah, I'll meet you by my office in 5 or 10 minutes.
Okay.
Is that good?
What number?
265. It's like the number of days in a year,
okay.
Except second floor.
Okay.
I know. I always forget to send it out. Not this week. Do you think it's a good idea to do it next week? Yeah, okay. You can send me an email Saturday or Sunday. Okay. Good questions today. Not so in our division meetings. It's the back row that's really protected seats. So we can rest our head up against the wall and listen to the dean talk. Yes.